You know, it's such a huge monumental task. You know, convert the entire country. I mean, that's insane. That's ridiculous. But you chip away at it. You know, bit by bit, it's all you can do. Increment by increment, bit by bit, and you work towards progress. And that's exactly what she did.
With me is Bruce Goldfarb, a former EMT and paramedic and an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared on All Things Considered, The Washington Post, USA Today, American Health, Baltimore Magazine, and many other print and online publications. Since 2012, he's been executive assistant to the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland. He is a public information officer for the OCME and is a curator of the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. He's here today to talk about his new book, 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of Francis Glessner Lee and the Invention of Modern Forensics. Bruce, welcome to Science for the People.
Hi, Rochelle. Very nice to talk with you.
So most people probably haven't heard of Francis Glessner Lee, but probably many of our listeners who are, by their nature, wonderful nerds for whom this is right up their alley, many of them will have heard of the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. But before we dig into Lee and her contributions to modern forensics in the U.S. and the kind of why the Nutshell Studies actually came into existence, we should probably not bury the lead too badly. So let's start with a really quick overview of what the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death are before we dig into how they came to be.
Well, the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death are a collection of 18 dioramas built on a scale of 1 inch to 1 foot that depict death scenes, which are used for training police officers in a week-long homicide seminar. And they're basically just a teaching tool, a three-dimensional object to practice the skills of observation.
Can you give us a little bit of sense of the detail in them? Because I think some people, when they hear the word diorama, they might think of like something they made in grade school in a shoebox.
Yeah, these are a little more sophisticated than that. They're, I guess, superficially look like dollhouses. They're rooms. There's a couple of them that are multiple rooms or exteriors. And they are just about as close as you can get to a real crime scene, to a real death scene. They have furniture is handmade, with drawers that open and close. There are doors and all the clothing is handmade. There's a tiny, there are hand-rolled cigarettes and an overflowing ashtray. Each one of these dioramas cost to build about as much as it cost to build a real house. So a fortune was spent on creating them.
So I first learned of the Nutshell Studies in, I want to say, about my early 20s, when my grandmother, who herself used to make the most amazingly denatured miniatures, gave me a coffee table book on them at this time. And I think it was because when I was a teenager, she used to have coffee table books of other really famous dollhouses that I used to spend hours and hours flipping through when I went to her house. And so in my 20s, when I got my first apartment and moved into my first home that was just me, she gave me this as my first coffee table book. And I was fascinated by it. I had never heard of them before. And I don't even think I actually read the book for a couple of months. I just loved endlessly flipping through the pages and looking at all of the pictures. These miniatures are so amazingly detailed and also kind of like very macabre, as one would probably imagine, given that they're studies of death.
I suppose they may be a bit macabre. Corinne Botz's book that you're talking about, called The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, and she's a wonderful photographer, graduate of the Maryland Institute College of Art. And yeah, that book is, I have it myself, it's just chock full of just beautiful, beautiful pictures that she has done. And it's been a while, but that's a tremendous book. Yeah,
It's such a fantastic book. And that was my first introduction to them. I had never heard of them before that. And honestly, I hadn't seen much about them since getting that book. So I'm curious to see how you first came across the Nutshell Studies.
Well, I first heard about them. I wrote about them in 1992 when I was doing journalism full time, and I wrote about them for the weekly newspaper of the American Medical Association called American Medical News, and it was, you know, just one of those one-off stories that they paid very well for, and it kind of kept recurring. I kept coming back to it. I visited the medical examiner's office many times to look at them again, and people would want me to arrange visits and those sorts of things. So I was mesmerized from the get-go. As a collection of art, I was very interested in the craft that they represented and the skill as in model making. They're just amazing.
So what made you want to write this book in particular, which is definitely not just about the Nutshell Studies? It's really more about Francis Glessner Lee and that era of forensics and sort of how modern forensics came to the United States.
Right. Well, because through my job, and I was fortunate enough to get employed as the chief's assistant and public information officer, and the guy who was the keeper of the secrets of the dioramas, Jerry D, asked me to, you know, sort of look after the Nutshells and change the light bulbs and those sorts of things. And I became the person that people would go to. A photographer wanted to take some pictures, or somebody wanted to do a story or that sort of thing. They'd be directed to me. And I was really the only one who was willing to accommodate visitors. And, you know, these people would ask, first of all, I, you know, she's an amazing person, Frances Glessner Lee, and I was always interested. So, you know, I consider myself, you know, a big fan. And people would ask these questions that were fairly obvious. You know, how did she get involved in forensic science, and why did she choose? What are these dioramas based on, and what was she like as a person, and, you know, all these things. And I didn't know the answer, and it was really pretty obvious. And in reading, what was available online, there was a lot of misconceptions. There were myths. There were things that were this persistent story that she was forbidden to go to college, which is not true, that her parents forbid her to go to college, and those sorts of things. And it was just very it was frustrating. And in talking with William Tyer, who is the curator of the Glessner House, which is now a museum in Chicago, and we sort of bemoaned the, you know, the fact that, you know, it's a shame that, you know, there's no biography. Her story's not been told. And, you know, it became obvious that there was a need to have it told. And so I was sort of designated as her biographer, and it went from there.
So can you tell us a little bit about the era she grew up in and what kind of background she came from? So give us a sense of time and place for people who don't even know the era that the Nutshell Studies come from.
Well, what interested me about Frances Glessner Lee was that her lifespan basically was bookended from the advent of fingerprinting, to the advent of DNA. She was born in 1878, which was Gilded Age Chicago. She came from a very wealthy family. Her dad owned a piece of International Harvester, and they were quite affluent, one of the wealthiest families in Chicago. And she was homeschooled, she and her brother, by the finest educators that money could buy in Chicago, and trained in the classics and mathematics and art and music and all these things. And she had an extraordinary upbringing, and was married young, at age 19, 20 years old, was married for a few years before she was divorced. They had three children. But she had a rather, you know, she was raised in the social graces. There was a cultured family steeped in art and the music, big supporters of the Chicago Symphony, and just not a person who would be likely to become a trailblazer in the field of forensic science.
One would have expected her to become perhaps a lady of Chicago society, not necessarily a leader in forensic science. For sure, looking at her background and her upbringing, that would have, I'm sure, was the expectation of the people around her as well.
Sure. That was certainly her trajectory. She married well, and I don't think anybody would have blamed her. She spent the rest of her life going to, you know, lectures in the decorative arts and functions and teas and cocktail receptions and those sorts of things, as people of wealth did and still do. But her life took a very different turn.
Can you talk a little bit about the state of legal medicine in the U.S. when Lee was a young adult? I'm thinking sort of the age of 20 when she would have started to become a bit interested in forensics.
Since the days that this country was established as a colony, we were in the coroner system, which dates from the Middle Ages. The coroner, the constable, the justice of the peace, these are all officials from medieval England. And the coroner system is very different. The coroner had the responsibility of investigating deaths that were sudden or unexpected, and they had a combination of medical, judicial, and law enforcement responsibilities. And what they would do is to hold a coroner's inquest, and to get it's a lot like a grand jury. Get a group of 10 or 12 adults together. They were required to view the body, and they would hear from witnesses, and then they voted. Who thinks it's an accident? Who thinks it's an act of God? It's sort of crowdsourcing death investigation. And so the medical examiner system is a medical model where a physician is in charge with that training and expertise to diagnose cause, manner of death. And the first medical examiner system in the United States was established in 1877 in Boston, Massachusetts. And by the time Francis Glessner Lee got involved in the 1920s, their medical examiners existed in three places. They were in Boston, New York City, and in Newark, New Jersey. The rest of the country was still on the coroner system, which was still had a tendency towards corruption, bribery, kickbacks, indifference, incompetence, and it was really less than satisfactory in many cases.
What about the state of forensics outside the U.S.? What was the state of legal medicine internationally, for example, in Europe?
Well, I mean, medicine was quite advanced, but much of the world, including the U.K., there are variations of coroner, but there's still much of the world is still on the coroner system, although they rely on forensic pathologists to provide the cause of death information to them.
So how did Lee get interested in forensics in the first place at this time, I think broadly known as legal medicine? What got her into this topic?
She was introduced to what was then called legal medicine, now called forensic medicine, by a friend, a family friend, a fellow who went to Harvard University with her brother, a doctor by the name of George Burgess McGrath. And McGrath was trained as a pathologist and then in 1907 was appointed the medical examiner for Suffolk County, which included most of Boston. And so McGrath went to Europe to train in the medical centers in Europe at the time, and he spent time in Edinburgh and London and Paris and Vienna, and to learn legal medicine, and then came back to the United States and incorporated that into his work as medical examiner and also to the lectures that he provided to medical students at Harvard Medical School. Throughout New England, he gained this reputation as a crime doctor, and he was involved in many really high-profile cases, such as the 1919 molasses disaster that many of your listeners are probably familiar with, and the Sacco and Vanzetti case and those sorts of things. So he had quite a reputation as a forensic investigator, but he was America's first forensic pathologist. And so he introduced Francis to this emerging field and explained to her, just as we've been having this conversation about the coroner system, medical examiners and the deficiencies and all that. And she really took up that mission as her life's work for the rest of her life, and ended up spending a good deal of her fortune to make sure that McGrath's ideas of forensic medicine took root and flourished in the United States.
The first chapter of her pursuing this as a cause, which she really did take up in her life, really is bound up in her friendship with McGrath and his experiences as a medical examiner. It felt like reading through your book that without him and without his expertise and his experiences and all of his case write-ups that he had, that it feels like Frances Glessner Lee may never have taken this up in the same way that she did.
That's probably true. They spent time together in 1929. They were both received some medical care in Boston and spent time together recuperating. And it can pretty much narrow it down to, you know, almost not quite a day, but it was in the summer of 1929, August, when he, you know, basically flipped a switch in her mind and got her turned on to this whole concept of legal medicine. And I, you know, it probably would have emerged in the United States at some point anyway. It's just a natural progression of things. But a lot of its growth and its existence, a lot of it is due to Frances Glessner Lee and her work and her efforts.
McGrath was quite well known within his jurisdiction. That doesn't necessarily mean he was universally liked. He was part of a few controversial cases. And actually, I recall somewhere in the book, you talk about how some of the people within his jurisdiction who didn't like the way he approached his work, he was framed to try and get him fired or potentially arrested. Yeah.
That is true. He stepped on toes. You know, the coroner is a powerful position. There's a lot of money potential for graft, and so he stepped on toes. The medical examiner, and one thing I don't think that a lot of people understand is that the medical examiner is a doctor, and they have the same relationship with the decedent as any doctor does with his or her patient. And so, you know, when somebody dies, there's all these people, funeral homes, but they're not really looking after the decedent's interest. The funeral homes exist for the family. The police are looking for, if it's a foul play, they're looking for the bad guy. So, you know, nobody else is really concerned strictly and only with that decedent's interest. And so he stuck very, you know, he was a prisoner to the truth, whatever it may be, whatever the science showed. And so he wouldn't play ball with prosecutors. He wouldn't say what he wouldn't go along with the police when they had a theory. And so, he was just his own man. And, sometimes that ran counter to what other people wanted, but he was dedicated to his practice and to his decedents. Those are his charges.
I remember you talking about in the book as well how even beyond when he was engaging with the public or the police or legal people, even with Frances herself, when they were just sitting and talking as friends, he was very strict with himself about what cases he would talk about and what cases he wouldn't. And he was very steadfast in not wanting to discuss any case that was still ongoing and still undecided within the legal system, which I'm sure is a standard that a lot of modern forensics people with their friends or spouses don't always adhere to.
You know, strangely, that is still the practice at the OCME of Maryland today. Nothing about a case is discussed publicly until it's resolved. It's worked its way through the courts. McGrath felt that, you know, scientific evidence belonged in a courtroom and that shouldn't be discussed and debated in the gossip columns of the papers. These are really serious matters and should be discussed seriously. And so, you know, yes, a lot, you know, I can't answer for what other places, you know, some places do or don't, what they do. But there are people who still take that that practice very seriously.
So when did McGrath and Lee start to get involved with the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard, or perhaps should I say start to create the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard?
Well, they spent that summer together in 1929, and Frances at the time was 52 years old when she learned about legal medicine and what needed to be done. She came to realize that there were three things that needed to be done in order to advance the country and move away from the coroner system to the medical examiner system. One thing you needed was to increase the manpower. There needs to be an army of well-trained doctors who are qualified to diagnose cause and manner of death. And so what she did was to, in 1931, she began giving money to Harvard Medical School in order to support George McGrath's work at Harvard, his lectures and what he was doing with students. And then a few years later, in 1936, she donated a collection of books to establish the Library of Legal Medicine, which she named the George McGrath Library of Legal Medicine. And it was the largest of its kind in the world at the time. And in 1936-37, she donated the equivalent of $3.8 million to form an entire academic department, a whole new field of medical practice with lectures and training and a fellowship to make medical examiners and laboratory and research and teaching materials with the moving pictures and lantern slides and all these things and just the whole thing, which that's what they began in the late 1930s. And that was the first program in legal medicine in the country that she established at Harvard Medical School.
And this began a long and sometimes tumultuous relationship with Harvard.
Yes, for the rest of her life. It was quite complicated. She was very conflicted with Harvard on the one hand. You know, she and her family, the Glessner families, were very dedicated to Harvard. She felt great affection for it on some level. It was her ex-husband, Blewett Lee, and all the important, her brother, the architect of her home, H.H. Richardson, all the important men in her life went to Harvard. And that was the one place that she would have liked to have gone to medical school, but Harvard didn't admit women until 1945. So, you know, she did feel it was, you know, the best of the best and had that prestige and that name recognition, and it was important for her to base that program at Harvard. Yeah.
One of the most amazing things about Frances Glessner Lee that I definitely did not know before reading your book was she was a lady who knew how to get things done. She knew a lot about legal medicine. She did her homework there. She knew a lot, probably more than most anyone else who wasn't actually training to be a medical examiner. But boy, did she really know how to play the political and lobbying game to move her goals forward. And she was very focused and knew what to do and knew how to present it and how to talk to people and get where she needed to go and pull strings and push buttons. And it was fascinating to read about how she pushed that cause forward in a way that wasn't teaching classes. It was a very women of the 1930s way, which I loved.
She was a force of nature. she, you know, she was determined. But, you know, the thing was that her whole life, you know, she had been raised with these social graces and to have a cocktail party with a very heterogeneous group of various people and politicians, musicians. But that's what she was good at, was getting people to do things and come together and to, you know, sit at a table and socialize. And she used her, these graces, you know, to a greater good. And she, you know, forced her way into meetings with J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, got Harvard to, as stodgy and stuffy as they were, that she got Harvard to do her bidding. But yeah, she was quite a personality.
What would the response to her and her cause have been at the time? I am sure she was not the only woman of her age or her stature pushing forward a cause, but I suspect that her particular cause of legal medicine was quite a departure from what other 50-year-old women were pushing forward at the time.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, at its basis, you know, there was validity to it. You know, there was an obvious and clear need for an improvement in how deaths were investigated. It was just such a humongous undertaking that it just seemed, you know, just so daunting for any one person or group of people to undertake. You know, she was persistent, and it was something that needed to be done, and she was determined to spend the rest of her life working towards it.
I really enjoyed also learning how much time she spent actually learning about the legal medicine side herself and thinking about how not just she could get the right people in the room, but also would put forward extensive proposals to state coordinators on how to begin the process of moving from a coroner system to a medical examiner system that were robust and well thought out in particular to that state. And I thought, it made me want to go and read those documents to see the things that she had put forward or the proposals that she had, because I never would have assumed that the 50 or 60 year old woman who created these miniature scenes of death that I was so fascinated with would also be, you know, setting forward detailed proposals of these kinds of natures. It was fascinating.
And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book, because when you read about Frances Glessner Lee, she's so often depicted as this doddering, rich old lady who made these creepy dollhouses, and that's pretty much it. But she really was, she was an educator. You know, she really understood curriculum development, and this whole program sprang from her mind. She was not a dilettante, and she was really regarded as the preeminent criminologist of her era. She was a voracious reader. The books that she collected for her library, she read them all. She could read in German and Latin and Italian, French, you name it. And she was just a brilliant person, and she had a great ability to incorporate facts and to devise a strategy for a way forward. But you know, I really, you know, wanted to get away from this. The whole Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, as remarkable as they are really almost an asterisk in what she did with her life, almost parenthetical. It's amazing, but what she really did is so much more than that. And that's what I tried to get through in the book.
Oh, absolutely. I love that in the book you open with the Nutshell Studies, because that motivates people to learn more about the person who created them. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I grabbed the book, was like, oh, I know these Nutshell Studies. I loved these. I've read a lot. You know, I thought I had read a lot about them, and I had never really read that much about the woman who created them. So I was super in to read about her, and so fascinated to learn about her life and her contributions and the way she pushed science forward and the way she pushed education about forensic science forward. Definitely something that I didn't know, a history that I didn't know, which was super interesting. What also kind of fascinated me was that she was a woman of clearly means. She was very wealthy, but she was also fully in control of her own resources as well, because she was divorced and didn't remarry, and was very much in control of where her finances went. And I assume as well that a woman who, of her interest and her capability, but also fully in control of the fortune she had in her at her disposal, was probably a pretty good force to be reckoned with at the time.
She was very shrewd as a business person. She said that, you know, you couldn't help being a daughter of John Jacob Glessner, who was a vice president of International Harvester. You couldn't help be his daughter and not be really good at business. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, what struck me, one of the things that strikes me about her is that she could be so amazingly generous and just really spend lavishly on police departments and sending smoked turkeys for the Christmas and buying chairs for Harvard faculty and all kinds of gifts and spending. But she would also, if a set of dishes was in not quite the right scale for her diorama, she would send it back to the shop and, you know, insist on her refund of $1.67 and those sorts of things. So she kept track of every single penny, and she knew exactly what she was doing at all times. She was absolutely in control.
Fascinating to read, for sure. Do you think it made a difference for her not having perhaps a husband or an overbearing father who was perhaps had a stake in some of where that money was going?
That's been one of the narratives that you read online. Mm-hmm. Was that Frances wasn't able to didn't have her agency until her father had died, and there wasn't anybody to disapprove of what she did and all these things. But there's no evidence that anybody ever really disapproved. Mm-hmm. Because she began doing this in 1931. Her mom died in what, 34? Her dad died in 1936. So there's an overlap there. He was around when she was doing some of these things. I don't know how much they talked about it. I don't think that she would have been dissuaded one way or another. She was, truly an independent woman.
So after McGrath retired, Alan Moritz came and began to helm the teaching and professorial side of the Department of Legal Medicine. Can you talk a little bit about who he was and where he kind of came from and how he got involved?
In the late 1930s, when they're just establishing this Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard Medical School, it became increasingly apparent that George Burgess McGrath was not well. He had jaundice and liver failure, and there's cellulitis in both hands, and he had some issues with alcohol and possibly some other substances, and it was really clear that he was not going to last too much longer. And there was a search to find a successor for George Burgess McGrath, and there was a short list, and that led them to Alan Moritz, who was basically third in command at the Pathology Institute of Case Western University in Cleveland. And he was a young pathologist who had been doing some work in vascular research and was making a name for himself. And they approached him with the idea of, since there was nobody else in the country who had the qualifications and training to take over McGrath's job, the next best thing was to find somebody who was extremely talented and promising, and then send them off like McGrath did to Europe to be trained. They talked, after some back and forth, they talked Alan Moritz into taking the job. After spending about a year and a half, 2 years in Europe, studying at the medical centers there, he came back and helmed the department in 1939.
So how did Moritz and Lee get along? Because obviously Lee started this great project with McGrath, someone she was very friendly with and had been a longtime associate of hers and friend of hers. How did she do with Moritz?
She, you know, she always respected his qualifications as a pathologist. There was no doubt he was very, very bright, very smart, a top-notch pathologist. She did warm up to him a bit socially. You know, she invited him and his wife and their children, the whole family, to visit at her estate in New Hampshire, the Rocks, and you know, showered the family with the gifts and those sorts of things. But you know, Moritz was you know, a pathologist first and a forensic pathologist second, and he would always seem to be more interested in himself than the field of forensic medicine. And in time, their relationship became strained. She was always making demands of him. Although, you know, he did an awful lot for the field of forensic medicine. I don't think his heart was absolutely 100% into it. He felt that he'd put in his year, a decade, at the chairman, and he did what he was asked to do, and it was time for him to think of himself. And you know, ultimately, they didn't exactly have a falling out. She did have some. They each had some unkind things to say about each other, and she felt that he was untrustworthy and ambitious, and you know, those sorts of things. And Moritz, you know, at one point said, "Yeah, well, you know, she has no actual qualifications. She's just basically a." You know, an old lady with nothing better to do. So that's the way they got along.
So it was a complicated relationship, much like her relationship with Harvard.
I think much of what Frances Glessner Lee did was complicated.
Fair.
Probably a recurring theme in her life.
She was good at complicated, though, and I think that shows, because there are a lot of people, even as dedicated as Lee was, who would have taken some of those complicated people or complicated situations and maybe said, you know what, it's not worth my time. But it seems like she was just relentless, and just even in the face sometimes of frustration and pushback, and even when plans didn't go quite right, she was just like, okay, what's next? And
isn't that amazing?
It's so amazing.
She never got discouraged, and she never, you know, just felt defeated. And anytime there was a setback, exactly, she'd say, all right, time to work up our, you know, roll up our sleeves, and we'll redouble our efforts, you know?
And
amazing.
And I didn't get the sense reading about her that it was ever a false cheer or a false hope. She was very clear where she had failed or something hadn't gone right and wanted to try to understand why, but she never seemed to feel like a sense of true defeat. She was always just like, okay, let's go on to the next strategy then, or let's talk to the next state, or let's talk to the next police department.
It's a, you know, it's such a huge monumental task, you know, convert the entire country. I mean, that's insane. That's ridiculous. But you chip away at it, you know, bit by bit. It's all you can do. Increment by increment, bit by bit, and you work towards progress. And that's exactly what she did.
So I want to talk about when she first got involved with training police, because we've talked a lot about training doctors and training medical examiners.
But right.
Another piece of that puzzle is training police, people who actually investigate the homicide or the first to the scene. So can you
talk
a little bit about when Frances Glessner Lee first got involved with training police?
Sure. Well, I started to mention that there were three things that she identified that had to be done. We talked about the manpower. You have to establish the program to train doctors to be medical examiners. The second part of that is reforming the laws to abolish the coroners and establish a medical examiner system. And the third piece is to train the police officers, because at the time, by and large, police men were untrained. In many places, you didn't have to have a high school diploma. Some police and coroners were functionally illiterate. And, you know, you didn't have to be smart to be a police officer if you could coerce a confession. So they really, cops were big, strong guys, not necessarily the smartest guys. And so it was, Lee recognized that it was important to train police in basically forensic science, not to make them forensic scientists, but to get them to understand the importance of preserving evidence. When you're at a crime scene, you know, they're used to do, you know, walk through blood or, you know, move the body and tamper with things that, you know, what they do, what the police do in those first moments can affect everything else. So it was absolutely critical that they understand what can be learned, what evidence there may be, to recognize it, to preserve it so it could be processed and interpreted correctly. But the first step is to recognize it. So that's what she did. And she had been fostering relationships with the police departments through the 1930s, and in the early 1940s began formulating an idea of a formal training program. And at first thought of maybe doing a 1 or 2 year program, and that got nowhere. But she and Moritz devised this week long homicide seminar, 5 days, all day, very intensive, where police would learn about sharp force injuries and blunt force injuries and drownings and poisonings and all these things. They would also observe an autopsy and learn what the medical examiner is looking for. And that's where the nutshell studies came in as the piece of that. What better way of learning how to observe a crime scene? Obviously, I mean, you can't take the whole group to a real crime scene. That would be great. But that's not practical. So the next best thing is to make these little miniatures that are an eternal set of facts that the group can study and use for the same experience.
So can you talk a little bit about what the training seminars were like? I mean, in the first place, teaching police has got to be a very different thing than teaching doctors.
It is. And she learned that before you train the police, you need to train the leadership. And it wasn't enough. For one thing, she selected these homicide seminars when they began in 1945. They were by invitation only. So Frances Glessner Lee had to individually choose this person. She looked for men who were early enough in their career so that they wouldn't – she didn't want people who were too close to retirement age, because then it wouldn't get a lot of value out of the training. It had to be a young person who was interested in this. But before you train the police officer, you need to train the chief of police so he deploys, so he understands – what this training does and what could be expected from a forensic investigation, because she didn't want to provide training to somebody and then they'd be assigned to a desk. So these people had to be used. They had a moral duty and responsibility to use these skills that they had been given towards solving suspicious and unexplained deaths. And so the courses which began in 1945, are actually very similar to what is done today. They're very social in nature. The curriculum, if you looked at the program from 1945 and today, it's virtually identical, very few changes. Introduced some DNA and those sorts of things, but it's still blunt force injury and sharp force injury and drownings and shootings and an autopsy and those sorts of things. During the seminar on the second evening, in Francis's mind, it was important that these people recognize that they are an elite corps. They've been given very special training. And so she took the entire group and hosted them a very, very fancy dinner that ended up costing her, you know, $25,000, $30,000 out of her own pocket back then, when $25 really, counted a lot. And so a very fancy mule and china that had been acquired just for the seminar at the Ritz-Carlton hotels, and just the centerpieces alone would cost thousands. Every little detail was planned out by Frances, and the seating arrangement and all these things. And it was very important for her that they get a diploma that said Harvard. So she established an organization called Harvard Associates in Police Sciences, HAPS. And HAPS is a membership organization that is basically continuing education. They do an advanced seminar. So the purpose of HAPS and the homicide seminar is to get these officers to network with one another, to associate with one another, and to keep in touch and to assist one another with their work. And so she really did create the entire area of what we now, you know, would think of as a homicide squad, homicide detectives.
She also would bring in female police officers to these programs as well.
She did. She began in, what was it, 47, 48? It didn't take long. It was only within a couple of years that women were a part of it. And that was a real eye-opener for many police officers. It was the first time that they encountered a woman police officer, and they had their eyes open, and they would go back to their own departments and talk with the chief about maybe hiring a few female police officers. And but she did. And there were women were a part of the homicide seminar every year ever since.
I love the strategic way that Lee went about setting up these seminars. She's so shrewd, thinking about not only who's worth bringing to the seminars, but how to make sure that their skills are leveraged properly when they get back, and that their skills are disseminated when they get back and appreciated when they get back, and also trying to raise the profile of women just starting to get into the field of policing. I just love how shrewd and strategic Frances Glessner Lee is.
She was very strategic, and she was very determined, you know, with as little that she had to work with. You've got to make sure that you're getting the most out of it. It would be an absolute waste to train a police officer who's not going to use those skills. So, I mean, I think it really shows a lot of insight and forethought that you're going to make sure that you get the right people, and that they're going to, you know, end up doing what they're supposed to do when they get through it.
So it's during this period that, as you said, the Nutshell studies were created. Can you give us a sense of about how long they took to build?
It's not entirely clear. She did have some help. The Nutshells were constructed between 1943 and 1948. And the records indicate that most of them were more or less completed by 1945. So the bulk of them were done. There were at least 10 or 12 that were completed between 43, 44, 45 when the first seminar began. And, you know, she did do some changes to things over the years. She'd move a victim from one diorama to another, and they're sort of fluid in that way. But the bulk of them were done during that time period, which was during World War II. And something I didn't realize, you know, I had been looking at these things for years and years and years, and it never dawned on me that they were done during wartime. And so there were material shortages for all kinds of things, metals and steel and little parts, plastic, all kinds of things were scarce and hard to come by, impossible to come by. So every little thing that she used to make the dioramas was a real struggle.
Not just materials, but there were other challenges that she ran into. For example, you can't just go to a shop and buy realistic looking miniature dead people.
No, as it turns out, you can't. And the only figures that she could find were sort of cartoonish, and they had a base, so they were meant to stand upright, which was not at all right for her purposes. She needed figures there with the, you know, limbs splayed or limbs broken and these sorts of things. So she ended up making her own. And all the they were all from custom pieces. She sewed all the clothing individually. They're even detailed. There's one, for example, there's a woman, sadly dead on a set of stairs, and there's a hairnet. Well, the little porcelain head, there's a little porcelain head with a wig on it. There are hair curlers in the wig and then a hairnet over the hair curlers, which seems to me that's just pretty impressive, finishing touch, which has absolutely no value as a, it's not a clue at all. But there it is. And those sorts of things. So,
I mean, the layering of detail, I think, and I know from reading the book and having looked at, the book I talked about before, the coffee table book, that the layering of detail here is so important, not just as detail for detail's sake, but if everything was a clue, then it would be easy to find the clues. But part of solving a homicide or finding out and trying to figure out how and why someone died is picking apart just the pieces of their day-to-day life and the inconsequential items from the items that mean something. So a lot of that layering of detail is to create that just base layer of life so that the clues have to be figured out from everything else.
That's exactly right. If, you know, I see these in classrooms, they set up these crime scene rooms or crime scene corners, and there's a few props and, you know, there's one bloody weapon. I mean, you know what you're supposed to look at, and your eye is drawn to it pretty quickly. But by filling these dioramas with all sorts of extraneous, there's clutter, there's red herrings, and you absolutely, the details and some of the clues are so minute that you really need to concentrate and look for hours and hours. There are things that are small, literally as the point of a pen, the head of a pen, that you need to notice. It's overwhelming. It's just totally overwhelming that you can't, there's not a one of them where you can just look at it, get a glance, okay, got it, figured it out. You know, that's it. They're just, you don't know. And they're intentionally ambiguous. They're incomplete. And they're very unsettling because people naturally, they want an answer and they want to know what happened. But there's not enough information contained there to know what happened. It's not about who done it. It's not to be solved. It's just about seeing what you can see and then report your observations. So, they're just like in real life. They are filled with clutter and extraneous detail, and you know, just like real life.
One of the other challenges that she had that I know never occurred to me before reading the book was that pretty much I think all of the dioramas, or at least most of them, present working class or lower class people. If you ever go looking for pre-made miniatures that someone else has built, they typically represent a middle to upper class dollhouse life. So she really had to build a lot of this stuff from scratch, her or the person or the people that she worked with, because a lot of even what was available in the right scale for the typical use in dollhouses was just not appropriate for the types of scenes she was trying to build.
That's right. And you mentioned famous model makers. One of the others, you're probably familiar with Narcissa Thorne, the Thorne Rooms that are in Chicago. And that's exactly what it was. Now, Narcissa Thorne and Frances Glisner Lee, where they were contemporaries and friends and neighbors, doing similar work in a similar time period. But the work is entirely different. And that was the problem. She couldn't acquire, she actually wrote to a furniture maker, maker of miniature furniture, for Narcissa Thorne, and told him, you know, your stuff is absolutely lovely. It's exquisite. It's beautiful, but it's totally wrong for my purposes, because these are people of modest means. She's looking for things that are worn or broken, in bad repair. And so that was very difficult. And she ended up having to make a lot of the furniture, to her specifications because it just wasn't commercially available.
So why did she decide to show these kinds of scenes of lower and working class rather than upper class people where she could have perhaps sourced some of the items more easily?
Well, I think my theory is that homes of poor people are more interesting. If you look at a diorama where everything is all clean and in its own place and in good repair, you don't get a lot of personality out of that. I mean, you can walk into a nice house. It is sort of like, you know, it looks like a hotel lobby or, you know, hotel room. You know, one looks like another, and there's, you know, clean, nothing out of place. It doesn't tell you a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But there's something more, I think, you know, it says more when you see the detritus of an everyday life, you know, the clutter, you know, homes. The light switches in the dioramas, the light switches have smudges, the paint's been, their walls have been patched and worn spots and you know, it looks the way a home looks.
Can you talk a little bit about the cabin fire diorama? This was one of my favorites. And as with all of them, they're based on a real case, though some of the details have been a bit changed.
That one, Burned Cabin, which is based on, I was so excited because I was reading, I've always admired the Burned Cabin because, you know, these things did cost, she spent thousands of dollars on each one. And it did cost approximately what it cost to build a house. And she made this one and then took a blowtorch to it. You know, she literally had money to burn. And I've talked with model makers and all sorts of people, and you know, it just mystifies people. Not just that you would burn it, but how you burn it so carefully, so precisely, and how do you put it out without, you know, like splashing, you know, can't pour water on it or something like that. She controlled the burn and did it so beautifully. But that one, and I'm reading, there are certain details, I don't want to give it away, but there are certain details about that one that made me think of, the murder of Florence Small, committed by her husband, Frederick Small. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, there are just too many coincidences, too many similarities. And I just had this weird thought. I was so excited. I'm reading about it. And I couldn't wait to get to the office the next day to look for an alarm clock. I thought that would just nail it for me. If there's an alarm clock in this, that would just be it. So I looked, and right there, right in the foreground, on top of the dresser, there's the alarm clock. And I can't believe it. It's got to be. That's, you know, obviously an allusion to or a tribute to, a nod to the Frederick Small's crimes. That's a pretty amazing one.
I'm interested to know how that one's fared over time in particular, because I'm aware from reading the book and from some previous reading that they have been somewhat restored, because like all things that are physical, they tend to degrade over time. But I am interested to know about what perhaps interesting, I don't know if you can say, but interesting challenges they may have had attempting to restore something that's been purposefully burned up.
They underwent conservation. Mm. And conservation, when it's done well, is invisible. If it's done properly, you shouldn't tell that something's been conserved. That diorama, which is burned, has parts that are as fragile as it looks. There are pieces of burned wood that were tissue paper thin. And the conservation work was done by a team led by Ariel O'Connor at the American Art Museum. She's a object conservator and previously worked for Air and Space Museum and done all kinds of amazing stuff. And that particular one, they did go on exhibit briefly in 2017, to the end of 2017 and beginning of 2019, at the Renwick Gallery of the Smithsonian, which is about 35 miles away down the street. And that was the big concern, because it was so delicate, and it was literally pieces of charred with charred wood and ash held together, not by much at all. But she found a substance, and I don't know exactly what it was, but there is some sort of some substance that was that she dripped into the wood, and it had to slowly absorb. It was not a cyanoacrylate. It wasn't a resin. It didn't change the finish at all. It didn't make it shiny. It wasn't like a polyurethane or something like that. But it was it absorbed the wood and strengthened it. It's in quite good shape now. That diorama, and at the same time, all of the lighting was switched up and upgraded. So things that were never properly illuminated are now lit, and the dioramas look as they were. They haven't looked this way since Frances Glessner Lee had her hands on them in the 1950s.
Oh, that's so fantastic. I seem to remember at the beginning of our discussion here today, and I also believe in the book, that I read that the dioramas are still being used for their original purpose. Is that correct?
That is correct. They are in Baltimore for the purpose of teaching, and they exist for teaching, and that's the only reason why they're at the OCME of Maryland. But they're still used in the homicide seminar, and they still serve a purpose that can't be done by any other means. They're still valuable for studying, and they're used as they were in 1945.
Has there been any effort to create more of them, to kind of continue them? Because obviously these objects won't last forever. All objects fade and degrade with time, even with the best conservation. So I'm curious to know if there's any interest in anybody creating new ones?
Not exactly like those. These, I have been assured that in the condition that they're in now, having undergone conservation, these dioramas should be good for decades. So hopefully they will exist for generations. But that's not forever. There is a professor at University of Maryland College Park who teaches, I forget if it's criminal justice, forensic science. He's done a number of, I think, 5 or 6 dioramas, not quite as detailed as the nutshells and that finally finished. But he's done some dioramas for teaching purposes. The most exciting thing that I'm aware of is at the University of Northern Michigan, there's a criminal justice program up there. There's a model maker by the name of David Maastrich, who has recreated, he recreated the Jeffrey McDonald Fatal Vision murder scene that was in the subject of the book, Fatal Vision, and the same scale, 1 inch to 1 foot, amazingly detailed. He's a very, very gifted model maker. And the program, in addition to the diorama, they've also collected and compiled ring binders of all this ancillary material. So they have crime scene photos, police reports, interview transcripts and notes and those sorts of things, so that students can reinvestigate this case anew, and they can just do it from scratch over and over and see what they come up with, which I think is an extraordinary experience. And I think it's interesting that in this 21st century, when we have virtual reality at our fingertips and all sorts of gee whiz technology and high resolution cameras in our pocket, that there's still no substitute for looking at a real 3-dimensional model and using that to practice, and is still better than any other medium, any other way of doing it.
I was thinking the same thing. It's you could potentially do something like 3D with enough time and effort as the technology improves, but there's something about having a physical thing in front of you that I think invites you to spend almost more time looking at it, that I don't know that I've ever, even when I've played with virtual reality, I don't know that I've ever spent as much time looking at something or investigating something. I mean, even just the pictures of it, I spent a lot of time looking at, because I've never seen one of these things in person. But I remember as a girl and as an adult looking at my grandmother's collection of handmade miniatures. And obviously they weren't scenes of death. They were, you know, a wide variety of miniature scenes, and boxes, but they were so fascinating and so detailed. And I could still, if you put one in front of me, I'd probably spend an unusual amount of time just looking at it.
I don't know what it is about miniatures that draws people in. It's spellbinding. If you show something miniature and they get quiet and they, you know, just sort of examine it, and you're just sort of sucked into it. You're drawn in, and your eye just gets lost in all these details. And you see it with children. I mean, they love detail. It's mesmerizing.
Bruce, it's been lovely talking with you today, and it was a fabulous book. Thank you so much for writing it, and I'm so happy now that I know a lot more about Francis Glessner Lee, as well as a lot more about the Nutshells.
I've enjoyed the conversation. I hope you enjoyed the book, and it's just been a pleasure to speak with you.
If you want to learn more about Bruce Goldfarb or his book, 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of Francis Glessner Lee and the Invention of Modern Forensics, as always, we have links to get you started in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at scienceforthepeople.ca. Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.